It was the blue-collar Titanic.
Safety was just utterly disregarded.
The owners knew that they had an unstable ship.
Look how she's tipping.
844 bodies?
He dove into that water.
People started calling him the human frog.
There was no iceberg, no torpedo. Someone surely did something wrong, and yet somehow.
Graft, corruption.
It's Chicago, you know. Somebody got paid.
July 24th, 1915 is the day we're talking about. That was the day of Eastland, Chicago's deadliest day. What a horrible day it was. Harvey Moshman and Chuck Kopler are here, the executive producer of Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, a documentary that you can watch on WTTW, Channel 11, premieres this Thursday, but plenty of other airings after then. Guys, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Here's the obvious question that I'm sure you've been asked before, but I will also ask you this question. It was such a horrible event, and yet there's so many people that just don't know about it. How can that possibly be?
It's just one of those things that, you know, when you witness something just so terribly, so horrific, that it becomes unspeakable. And if you're an immigrant in Chicago at that time, you didn't share this other than with other family members.
Yeah.
And you can imagine you're standing on the Clark Street Bridge and this thing turns over and 40 feet from you, there's 844 people dying and you can't do a thing about it. It's just a memory that you do not want to relive.
Also, and this is Chuck, by the way, I wanted to just add that the most of the victims were young women and children, you know, family members of the factory workers who were there. So who wants to remember that, much less commemorate that?
Right.
Then there's, you know, the race riots of 1919. There's the World War One, which the U.S. began getting involved in. It pushed the Eastland off the front page.
Let's tell the story chronologically. Why were there so many people on the ship? They were taking kind of a day tour, right? That was the original plan?
Well, it was a company picnic.
Yeah.
And it was organized by a group called the Hawthorne Club within Western Electric. And there were 7,000 people ready to go on five ships. The Eastland was the first to board. And 2,500 loaded on the Eastland. Then the tragedy happened. And, of course, the picnic was canceled after that.
And this was the biggest event of the year. This was a huge factory in Hawthorne, which, you know, was a part of Cicero. 20,000 people worked there. And this was the event where they chartered, think of it, a company in 1915 chartering five steamships to take their workers, their families, across the lake to ostensibly a company picnic. That's like Silicon Valley.
Right.
That's like Facebook or Google today.
Right.
And we all know, you know, the Chicago fire is what people always refer to as like the greatest tragedy, but 300 people died there, and there's almost three times the people that died here. So one of the things that I always find so amazing is when filmmakers find people that were actually a part of the story. And I understand that you guys have spoken with some of the people that were there.
Sure. So when we first did this project in 2001, and there were still some living survivors, and we interviewed them, we kept that footage knowing we would use it again someday. And so we have Libby Ruby, who was 10 years old at the time, and Bobby Onstad, who was also 13.
She was almost going to turn 14.
And we have their interviews, plus we found an interview with a survivor named Frank Blaha, and that was somebody recorded that in 1976, and we got a hold of that. So we have a lot of first-person accounts.
Yeah, and you see this in the documentary. We show these original interviews done decades ago, and through the years, I've done a few interviews with Libby Ruby. I remember her and talked with her, and she was a lovely woman, and she had a memory that was sharp as a tack about this incident. She remembered putting her hand up and someone boosting her over the rail. She remembered that clear as a bell.
And she lost family members, people close to her that day.
You know,
She was on the dock side of the ship. So this is how life rolls the dice. If you were on the river side of the ship, you were either drowned, suffocated, or in some terrible way likely to perish. If you were on the dock side of the ship, you simply crawled over the railing and walked off.
That was it.
And she and her her sister and brother-in-law were all rescued.
The blame for this was that they put too many people on the boat, right? Is that what they're saying was the reason for this?
Well, they're certainly, the boat was certainly full.
Yeah.
The rumor that almost everybody knows, if you know about the Eastland, there's one thing you almost everybody knows, is that too many people went to one side and that's what caused the tip to tip. That is absolutely not true. That's not what happened. You have a boat which is almost the width of between LaSalle Street and Clark Street.
Yeah.
That's how wide it was. And the ballast tanks in that ship were empty at the time. So the ship had been designed by someone who had never designed a passenger ship before, had only designed a cargo boat. And in cargo boats, the weight comes in and stays low and never moves.
Right.
In a passenger ship, the weight comes in the bottom and walks around to the top and so forth. And the ability of the ballast to counteract that movement was not possible on the Eastland. So it was not a nimble system. They could not take care of a load that large.
Yeah.
Not the least of which is that summer, they never had more than a few hundred people on the boat.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, they've got 2,500. They were just completely inept at being able to manage that crowd.
And our documentary really wanted to try and solve what really happened and why no one was ever held responsible for this. And so, yes, the construction of the ship, the fact that there were a lot of people, more people than that summer had ever been aboard that ship,
yeah,
plus more lifeboats, because this happened just a few years after the Titanic sinking, which led for new legislation that mandated more lifeboats on ships like this. All of that weight up top narrowed the margin of safety for a ship that was already had a reputation of being unstable.
So there's a famous story on 9/11 that Seth MacFarlane, the creator of Family Guy, just missed getting on that plane. He was supposed to be on the plane, and he's standing there berating the woman, you know, saying, "Hey, you know, I can see the plane. Open the door. Let me get on it." There was somebody quite famous to Chicagoans who was supposed to be on this ship.
Sure. George Halas played on the baseball team at Western Electric, and he was going to be out at the picnic that day. And depending on whose story you believe, he was late to get to the Eastland because his brother wanted to weigh him because he was trying to become a football player. And that delay caused him to miss the Eastland.
And that's true, because I've heard that rumor before, but we can yes, prove that that's true.
We believe that to be true. And interestingly, we had a private showing of this a couple weeks ago in Elmhurst, and Virginia McCaskey came as along with Pat McCaskey.
Wow, that's very cool. Was she moved?
Sure.
That was a qualified sure.
She doesn't talk a lot publicly.
Right.
So she wasn't very gentle.
She's not a public speaker,
right,
but she did stay through the end.
Yes, she did. All
she
right.
stayed
right
at the end and allowed her picture to
big
play.
Big fan of Virginia's.
Okay.
Harvey Moshman and Chuck Coppola are our guests. They're the executive producers of Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day. I urge you to see it. It's going to premiere Thursday right there on Channel 11 on WTTW, but plenty of other showings. What's the best way, Harvey, for them to get a complete list? Is there a list of this somewhere online?
WTTW.com has the list, and our website, EastlandDVD.com, has it. But Thursday, 8 o'clock, Channel 11 is the one to see.
All right, we'll pick this conversation up in a little bit. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill Leff and Harry Tynowitz in for Wendy on WGN.
Thanks. In the water, clustered so thickly that they literally covered the surface of the river. A few were swimming, the rest floundered about, clutching at anything they could reach, pulling each other down, and screaming. Helen Repa
worked for Western.
Harvey Moshman and Chuck Coppola are here. They're the executive producers of Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, a documentary about the Eastland disaster. It premieres Thursday, July 25th at 8 p.m. on Channel 11. Plenty of other showings. We'll get into that in just a little bit. Let's tell the story about the newsreel footage. This is fascinating to me. The newsreel footage of this event was banned here in the city of Chicago. Please, fellas, tell that story.
Right. So in the early teens, there was a silent film industry here in Chicago. So there were plenty of cameramen, plenty of cameras here. And there were three Newsreel Services, Tribune Selig, Mutual, and Universal, and they all were on the site within minutes after the disaster. And all of that film at that time was nitrate stock, which is a very volatile stock. It's so volatile that it burns underwater. It makes its own oxygen. This stuff is just deadly. And unless you deliberately transferred that image to a safety stock, an acetate stock, it wouldn't exist anymore. So for some miracle, some of that film actually was transferred. Somebody thought this was worth keeping, and it ended up in a stock library in the Netherlands, of all places. And Jeff Nichols, a U of I grad student, found this while he was looking for something else. He came across these shots, and that was the first time anybody had ever seen, certainly here in Chicago, any of that footage. That was 100 years. 2015 is when they found that. Now, that film was judged to be so difficult to watch that the mayor's office decided to ban it in Chicago.
Mayor Thompson was out of town at the time, so a committee with the vice mayor was here.
So they took that film, and that was distributed to 40 other cities that we know of in the United States. It even went to as far as Australia, where people saw it. You could see it on the other side of the lake. You could see it in Addison. You could see it in Benton Harbor. You could see it almost anywhere in the Midwest, but you could not see it in Chicago. So the first time that film has actually been broadcast in a shown in a public theater was just a couple of days ago showed it at the museum.
Harvey, Chuck, you know, if you make a documentary about something that happened a few years ago, like the Steve Bartman, another Chicago tragedy, you know, the Steve Bartman movie, like one guy made one in a week, you know, and other people did it like in a month. When you take on something like this that happened over 100 years ago, you are committing to a long haul. How long from the time you guys got together and said, you know what would be a really interesting film to make a documentary on, to the point where it was done?
Well, the first interview we shot was in May 2016. Then we took about a year off doing other things, and then we got back to it. So it took about 2 years solid up until last month.
And have you had any of the descendants reach out to you and say thank you for making this?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a huge community of families, relatives of victims and survivors, and many of them will be here tomorrow when the anniversary ceremony is held at the Riverside. But yeah, it's a huge group of people that are just fascinated by this. There's so much not known even among those people that they're all looking for more information and all trying to figure out how their relatives played a part.
And you also asked Harry about how difficult it is to do something that's not
right.
Yesterday's news, it's 100 years ago news. The participants are no longer with us. So what we had to do is we had to go through the National Archives to get the actual court transcripts. Harvey dusted off the boxes and went through it and saw the original documents. The one that has scrawled in the notes, owners knew. Owners knew this was an unstable ship, and yet they still got away with it. So going through those boxes is one thing. I was frustrated that I couldn't ask personally McClay Hoyne, the state's attorney at the time, why didn't you pursue charges here in the state of Illinois? I wished I could, but I couldn't.
What do you think the reason is?
I think it's because the feds had I don't want to give it completely away, but the feds had dropped the ball so badly in Michigan.
Yeah.
At the time, extradition law was different than it is now. The owners could not be compelled to come to Chicago to stand trial.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, they all lived in Michigan, and as soon as this happened, they beat it out of town and essentially said, we're not coming back.
Extradition law was different then. Yeah. It has been changed since. You can and are often brought, you know, back physically to stand trial.
And that's the last time that someone benefited from living in Michigan instead of Chicago.
Please tell the story of the human frog.
A young motorcycle mechanic is in his shop up near Pulaski and Irving, and he hears that the Eastland has turned over, and he happened to be quite a swimmer. He could hold his breath for 3.5 minutes, which is extraordinary. And he wanted to be a hero, and he wanted to get in on the action. So he got on his motorcycle, beat a path down to the river. The cops tried to stop him from helping anybody else. He beamed one of them, jumped in the river, and ultimately he pulled out 40 bodies from the hull over the course of several hours, and he was dubbed the human frog.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow.
True. His grandson will be here actually tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
We were lucky enough to find David Bowles, and he came to the preview a couple days ago, and he's a terrific person to talk with, and he's such a great storyteller as well. And he's going to be there. He's still staying in town to be at the commemoration tomorrow.
The human tadpole.
Right.
Grandson.
He's kept that in the family.
Yes.
Is this true or false that many of the bodies, upon being taken out of the water, were brought to the area that became Oprah Winfrey Studios, and that's why people say that that area is haunted? Is that true or
not? But the question is that same ghost haunting McDonald's now, or did that ghost leave when the building was torn down? Yes.
Great question.
No, but that's true. There were 700 bodies laid out on the floor of what became Oprah's studio.
Just waiting to be claimed, identified, that sort of thing.
Have you guys, I mean, this is, you know, hasn't even debuted yet, and we're looking forward to it Thursday night at 8 o'clock on Channel 11. Have you guys talked about what your next project is, or do you need, like, time off after doing something this emotional?
Oh, yes. Time off.
We have poured our heart and soul into this for two and a half years, and then some, you know. Gathering, we did 30 interviews that appear on screen. This, I can't tell you how many rewrites went back and forth between Harvey and me on this.
I can, 36.
36 right. Rewrites, Chuck.
But this has been one of the most satisfying projects I've had in 35 years working in news and reporting and documentaries with Harvey over the last 20 years. This has been one of those joys of being able to dive in deeply and research fully.
No pun intended.
And then have, true, no pun intended, and then have the time to actually sift through everything and try and put things in their proper perspective and context. We don't get that often in news. And so when a news person goes into documentary work, the first thing I found, anyway, was how satisfying this is.
Why do you think this hasn't been made into a film, not a documentary, but the way that Titanic took off? You would think this would be a natural for somebody to tackle this. Why do you think nobody has?
Well, if you're comparing it to the Titanic, you have a ship full of extremely wealthy, well-known people.
Yeah.
A manufactured love story. There's no reason that the Eastland couldn't have its own parallel to that, but that's not for me to think about.
Yeah. And still have Billy Zane running around being mysterious. I still want that part of it.
Okay.
Bill's going to go home and write that.
I am. I'm almost done. Guys, this is such a great project. Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day. Harvey Moshman and Chuck Coppola have put together this great documentary. You can see it starting Thursday on WTTW on Channel 11 at 8 o'clock. But then it runs a bunch more times. Go to EastlandDVD.com. Everything you need to know is there. Thank you, guys.
Thank you much. I want to give a quick shout out to Jun Fujita, Japanese immigrant to the United States, one of the first Japanese photographers in the city of Chicago, took a lot of the iconic pictures of the Eastland that we've seen in the various museums and exhibits around town. We were lucky enough to find his great-nephew, who has compiled an album of his work. He has embraced Jun Fujita's work, and Jun Fujita is a notable character in our documentary.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. We'll look for that. Congratulations.
All right.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
A little break and then some news and then more show. It's Bill and Harry in for Wendy on WGN.